Hello there, this is Mark Bauerlein again for another conversation. Today we have Nicholas Tampio, who is an associate professor in political science at Fordham University. He's the author of a book that is just out, is that correct?
Correct.
Just out from Johns Hopkins University Press called Common Core, National Education Standards and the Threat to Democracy. He is also the editor of the journal Politics and Religion. Welcome, Professor Tampio.
It's wonderful to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Great. Well, we're just going to talk for the next 30 minutes about this big project called Common Core, which goes back, I guess, officially about 10 years now.
Well, the standards themselves were finalized in 2010. They sort of the seeds for the idea came out of No Child Left Behind, for George W. Bush's signature education legislation from 2001-2002. But I would say when I teach my course in education policy, it goes back to the late 80s, early 90s, when Mike Smith and Jennifer O'Day wrote this article sort of laying out the idea for what eventually became the Common Core.
And the idea is national standards.
Well, it's national standards which make possible a national education system. So America has a tradition of local control. I mean, according to the Constitution, state control, but effectively a local control up until the mid-20th century. And then starting about 1965, you see this ramping up of federal presence. And the Common Core is just one big leap on that process.
Interesting, interesting. And tell us just really, what is Common Core?
So what Common Core is it's a collection of standards in math and English language arts from kindergarten to 12th grade. And what an education standard is it's a performance expectation. It says by the end of this grade, you should be able to do this in math and this in English. And
standard in English, say, is not going to, generally, it won't specify you must read Moby Dick in 11th grade.
No, you could have those kind of standards, but that's not what the Common Core standards are. They're skills, they're performance expectations. So one standard is that kindergartners should, by the end of kindergarten, should be able to read emergent reader texts with purpose and understanding. But at least in theory, localities have some say in how to fulfill that expectation.
Right, so demonstrate knowledge of the conventions of standard English. That might be...
Yes.
I mean, that's very general.
Yeah, that's a general one. I mean, part of the specific conversation we're having about the Common Core is that a lot of the standards expect students to cite specific textual evidence from the text that they are reading. And you and I are both scholars. We know that you have to cite sources and you have to be accurate when you do it. So that is a tool in the scholarly repertoire. The problem is when you place such an emphasis on that one skill that all these other skills get neglected and, from my perspective, totally skew the purpose of education.
It really was a big focus on the close reading, analytical kind of get into the text, pull little pieces out of it, cite them in your own argument, your own interpretation.
Well, but yeah. You were right until the last little bit, because it's you're not encouraged to say your own interpretation or whether you agree or disagree with it. So really what I argue in my book, Common Core, is that the key standard of the Common Core, and this goes throughout kindergarten through 12th grade, is the first English language arts anchor standard for reading. And what the first ELA anchor standard says is that when you read a text and you make an argument about the text, you must cite specific textual evidence. Cite specific textual evidence. And when you read the supporting literature about what that means, it means you must use the exact word from the text in your answer in such a way that computers can grade it.
Huh.
So basically what Common Core means for kids is you're given a passage of text, questions, you have to answer them using your own words from the text. So you're not reading whole bodies of literature, you're not reading very complicated things and trying to pick up nuance or connections. You're basically just this very mechanical way of reading and regurgitating evidence from a text.
You know, when you say that, it tallies with what I have observed in my students teaching English at Emory University. Pretty selective institution, so these are smart kids, strong SAT, ACT scores. They've taken AP classes. And what I have found in recent years is that the practice of reading and responding in their papers on the little tests that I give, it, the mechanical is the word. It's so procedural. And I want to say it's like you guys are shifting into the mode of technique to a fault. Mm-hmm. I mean, loosen up a little bit.
Yeah.
Use your imagination a little more. Think in bigger terms than, I mean, we want that close, specific, analytical precision, but it just seems there's something missing that I didn't see 20 years ago when you would get these sort of bookish, a little offbeat kids with this curiosity about things. And if you mention a book in class that isn't on the syllabus, they'll come back a week later and they'll drop by your office and tell you, you know, I looked at that and it was just a broader humanistic learning agenda than what seems to be. I think you hit the word with the mechanical aspect of it.
Well, you know, I just published an op-ed on the SAT, and what I discovered while researching the SAT is that students are given a passage of text. They have to answer about the text. They are not supposed to read the text from beginning to end. In fact, if you read the text in its entirety, you're doing something wrong. What it is that you're often given two types of questions, and the second question says on line 30, there's this word, what does it mean? And when you study the techniques, you're supposed to read the first few lines ahead of it, a first few lines behind it, and then you can answer the first question as well. So you never actually have to read the thing. So for what I would just say is that as a civilization, as a society, we're training children to approach, our young people to approach texts in such a way that they're not sources of meaning or joy or of thought. It's just right. Purely jump through the hoop so you can get a job and feed your family and get on with your life.
Right, and this is a little off topic, but one reason I find that humanities enrollments in higher education are dipping in history and English is precisely what you just said. These are not about works, about joy and inspiration, and they don't have power over young people's sensibilities. They are objects, and we apply our analytical tools to those objects. That's not going to make someone want to come back.
No,
you know, well, they read Great Expectations in 11th grade with a really good teacher who fired them up. And they want more. Or Jane Austen, and they want more than that. I think this kind of instruction is not going to get them excited.
Yeah, well, John Stuart Mill in On Liberty talks about our natural curiosity, our natural wonder as being a little plant. And, you know, sometimes plants can be chopped down, but what's often happened is that we don't give them enough water and sunlight. And I think that's how I would interpret what you were just saying, that we're not, kids want to read books. They want to find meaning in the human story. And, you know, when you're given these short little passages and told, you know, don't read the whole thing, if you want to do well, you internalize that message. And we've basically not given this little plant sunlight and wonder, and water. And they don't want to study the humanities anymore because their whole education up to that point has neglected that capacity.
When John Stuart Mill suffered his mental breakdown when he was a young adult, he actually turned to Wordsworth's poetry, and he said, reading Wordsworth's poetry, he said it was medicine for his soul. That's what we should be offering to students. Literature can be medicine for your soul. Sometimes it's tough medicine, but it can do things. It can reach down that much. Well, look, let's get back. The general issue. One of your chapters is what's good about national standards. What is good about national standards?
So I think the most persuasive argument is when you consider the other side's strongest argument. So what I dedicated a chapter to the strongest arguments, and the appeal of national education standards is that they promise to raise the floor for everybody. And so education in our country is often very widely disparate. And so if somebody came to you and said, listen, we've got this economical way to provide a good quality education to urban students, to rural students, to poor students, and these standards will be so good that they'll even raise the bar for the highest students. Well, shoot, who wouldn't be in support of that, right? That sounds too good to be true. It is too good to be true, right? I mean, so what I do in the book is I say, all right, here are the good arguments for, and here are arguments against. And one of my key arguments against is that reasonable people disagree on how to educate children. So in mathematics, some people say, just give them the math and have them learn the formula, the procedures, and if they get the correct answer, that demonstrates sufficient understanding. Another school of thought says, well, in real life, you have word problems, right? So why not give them that from the beginning? So there's this debate. When you have national education standards, you're telling the losers of this particular fight, you have no recourse in the democratic system. You can't move, you can't exit the system, you're trapped. And that breeds a lot of angry citizens. So you've got good arguments both sides. And then my proposal is, let's look at the specifics and let's look at the nitty-gritty, the devil is in the details. And what I hope to show in each chapter is that, gosh, reasonable people could be angry with a lot of the national standards on offer right now.
You know, when you mentioned how Common Core in those first anchor standards, they did emphasis using material from the text, and you have to be very faithful to the wording. Was that an effort to get away from what they saw as subjective orientations, letting students feel too much, a worry about fuzziness in the classroom? Well, we want sharper, less arbitrary and life story kind of impressionistic responses.
So the story that was told. So David Coleman, he's the person who actually wrote the standards. He gave a famous talk in Albany called "Bringing the Common Core to Life," and he said that what we had, the most common form of assignment in school right now, is personal essay, where people talk about their feelings, and we need to get people to focus on the texts themselves. And here's my response to it. When I went to school, there was a third kind of assignment, which was a research paper that I got to choose the topic. And so for me, I want school to be hard but interesting.
It gave you space to get in there and give an angle.
Absolutely. So even though the Common Core itself is, you know, the standards themselves do not have an ideology, a political ideology, whoever controls the curriculum controls sort of the ideological indoctrination, because students are not allowed to say that they disagree with the material.
They're not.
Right, no.
I think that's tyrannical.
It is tyrannical. I mean, that's a chapter I talked about, the AP US history exam, is that when you look at the materials, they have a left-wing ideological bent. Now, I come from a liberal family. I mean, the fact is that I don't necessarily disagree with every bit of it, but I still think we're America. We don't indoctrinate. We don't force people to say things that they believe. So I think a small D Democrat could still see a problem with indoctrination.
I think the way you came down on that in that chapter was very nice. The AP US History Revision, the revised framework, it came out in 2014, and it had a progressivist orientation. And a lot of conservatives, including the Republican National Committee, right, they came out against. Your position is, I'm not going to say that was wrong or stupid. I'm going to say you can't, if you've got a sizable number of people in the population who say, we don't like this kind of curriculum, you got to give them space.
Absolutely.
So you call for just more variety, more openness, more diversity. In that, which I think is the right call. And actually, I think there are some efforts underway to develop some alternatives to AP that one hopes will get authorized, because AP right now is a monopoly.
Yeah.
Right? And it's big, it's getting bigger, and they make a lot of money.
They do make a lot of money.
Taking those tests costs money. What is it? I think we have 500,000 kids every year take the AP US History test.
Right.
That's where we are. 500,000 take the test. You know, on the subjectivity issue, I remember I was in a standards meeting. Maybe it was with Achieve, that group. But We were developing standards, and I said, I used the word belletristic. I said, we need to get more examples of belletristic prose. And they immediately thought that I was saying, we want to let students write personal story.
Oh,
and I
man.
Said, no, belletristic is prose with an element of beauty to it, which could be, you know, the essays of Addison, you know, the speeches of Edmund Burke or Richard Brinsley Sheridan. Those prose models. That's what I mean by belletristic. But I could see in there that there was a concerted effort to get away from the emotive kinds of response writing in the classroom. I said, you guys are pushing too hard.
Yeah.
I know there's a problem, but you're hitting this with a sledgehammer.
Yes.
Here. So, okay. You have a chapter on religious minorities, how Common Core poses particular problems for them, and that I think our listeners will be especially attuned to.
So let me be precise, because the Common Core does not touch sexual education standards, and yet the effort to create national sexual education standards models itself on the Common Core. And when you're having a conversation about national education standards, that is one of the topics about sexual education. So what I did is I dedicated a chapter to the National Sexuality Education Standards.
And there is such a thing. NS.
Yes. It is a thing. I have friends in Utah who are fighting it, and their state adopted it.
What organization sponsored these and created these?
So there's FOSE is one of the main ones. There are a couple of other organizations that, you know, I don't know the exact history of the organizations, but I do know that they affect schools of education. And so that when teachers become certified to teach sexual education, they need to go through programs to get certified for it. So that's the way that those standards are becoming nationalized. And, you know, the fact is that there have been interesting surveys that talk about what parents are okay with schools teaching. And the fact is that there are some topics that schools are more, that parents are more or less okay with schools teaching.
Maybe STDs, protection side of things.
Those are not as controversial, but certainly things like anal sex or gender identity or abortion. Those are the real controversial ones. And so the fact of the matter is that when you see the advertisements for these, I often get them on social media, is that, you know, it's this revolutionary new approach to teach sexual health. And my view is that, wait a minute, we live in a democracy, and in a democracy, people have a say in how their children are educated. And what happens when one group gets to decide for the entire country how we're going to teach sexual ethics? And so for this particular chapter, I looked at Islam, just to scramble the political scene a little bit, right?
Because the usual option would be fundamentalist Christian,
right? And I said I'm not gonna play that script, because liberal secularists think they're gonna win that script. They've got a whole narrative, a triumphalist narrative of that. So let's try to scramble it up a little bit. And the fact of the matter is that there are many Muslims who believe that homosexuality is an act rather than an identity. So you no more are a homosexual than you are an adulterer. It's an act you do or you don't do. So my argument in this chapter was that one faction has abrogated itself the right to, or has given itself the right to determine the sexual ethics education for the entire country. And Muslims are not going to have any... are not going to agree with this. You're basically telling Muslim families that, listen, if you want to be part of our system, you have no say in education. You just have to buck up and take this view of sexual health. You know, my view is that if you keep doing that for every academic subject, you're going to get a lot of bitter, resentful people who are angry at schools, who are angry at the political process. It's not worth it.
We've got to maintain the pluralism here. I don't understand... Here's the question. Why would you want these kinds of standards Why would you want to disallow people from opting out?
So it's, the way I view it as a scholar of American political thought, among other areas within political theory, is that there's this recurrent debate in American political thought between Alexander Hamilton, who wants strong federal government with an important role for experts, and then on the other hand, James Madison and Thomas Jefferson, who are trying to preserve distributed power and trying to create space for people to participate in local politics. And I see myself as trying to remind us why James Madison and Thomas Jefferson made those arguments. The fact of the matter is that angels are not in charge of the political order, right? The fact is that any national education system you come up with is going to be objectionable to thoughtful people. And the founders explicitly did not put education as one of the federal powers. It would have been in Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution. They didn't do that because they knew this was such a controversial topic. You just had to let lots of little battles play themselves out rather than try to settle it from the top.
You know, I didn't think of it in that strong a light. It's usually just, you know, well, they like local control over education. But what you said goes deeper, saying education is a particularly potent area of local control. You especially because these are parents,
yeah,
and their children. This isn't someone with a business. It's mm-hmm. your own children are going in here. And to me, one wonders if the experts just don't trust the parents.
I think
they're not going to do it well enough. We've got to step in.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, when we've got, I mean, this is, again, you can respond to this, but when we do have, for instance, so many kids growing up in broken homes, single parent households, mm-hmm. even conscientious single parents, it's very hard to provide the reinforcement that will make schooling work for your children. But when you've got, say, devout Muslim parents, Orthodox Jewish mm-hmm. parents, I mean, many are going to have objections to the sexuality standards. Are they going to be able to say no? Or is this a legal issue now?
Well, I mean, I think I've been following the news sort of from a distance, but that's part of the big question. I think in California, there's a case brewing right now where parents are trying to take their children out of sexual education standards classes, and the school district is not allowing them. We're gonna have to see how it plays out in states. I mean, conceivably, it could go up to the Supreme Court. There's a great article by a UMass professor, Jesse H. Rhodes, showing what happens when you have top-down education reform. And what you see in states that have gone farther in the top-down education reform model is that parents start participating less in the local school. They stop volunteering for the PTA, they stop going on field trips, they stop running for school board. But then the effect is that they actually stop participating in the political life of the community. They check out. They no longer want to run for city office or county council or any of these other types of sort of entryways into this political sphere. So what you're seeing is that when you've got these top-down reforms, they really alienate parents from the schools, and they no longer check their kids' homework. They no longer stay in touch with the students' teachers. They no longer care about things. So, you know, I try to be fair. Maybe in some cases, national education standards could raise the bar for some students, but it comes at an enormous cost. Surely there's a way that we can make the schools better for the underperforming schools without this homogenous model that breeds so much resentment.
What do you think is going to happen in the next 10 years or so? I mean, Common Core is now adopted in 42 I mean, well, there are variations, right? Because some schools did accept the standards, or some states did keep the standards, but decided to do their own tests, correct?
Yeah, Texas famously didn't adopt the Common Core, but they were kind of the basis for the Texas miracle that George W. Bush sort of used as his model. So they share some many of the similar features. Virginia didn't adopt the Common Core, but you have a similar thing where Achieve worked on the dry run to the Common Core in Virginia. So their standards are very similar. When you've got these national tests like the SAT or the AP exam, they effectively act as national Common Core tests. And so even homeschoolers find it very difficult to escape the presence of the Common Core. They homeschool communities often take AP tests, and now all of a sudden, if the AP tests align with the Common Core, now that becomes this way that you rope the homeschooling community in. I don't know what's going to happen. I mean, my view is that we live in a democracy, or at least has elements of a democracy, and we shouldn't be forced to stay with an education system that so many parents hate. And so I'm not a spectator, I'm an actor. I'm finding allies all around in lots of different political parties, lots of geographical regions, lots of different stories.
I mean, in New York, the opt-out movement is growing, right? And that is parents who opt out of taking the Regents tests. Is that what they're called?
No. So
I
what
can't.
happens is Regent, you can't opt out of Regents and graduate. So the No Child Left Behind Act and then the Every Student Succeed Act of 2015, they specify that students are supposed to take exams at the end of grades 3 through 8 and once in high school. And so in New York, you see an opt-out movement for the students in grades 3 through 8. And they, at a minimum, they're saying the shoe doesn't fit, that this all of these education reforms we're dissatisfied with. And at one point, one out of five families was refusing the Common Core test, which is huge. Pretty much all the country was looking to New York and seeing what's going to happen. We're still in the middle of the story. I mean, the state education department is cracking down in all sorts of different ways. I mean, there's been rumors that in New York City, immigrant families have been told that they'll be deported if they don't take the test. I mean, I saw that story on Facebook. I mean, we should double check it. But the fact of the matter is that the state education department knows that it looks bad when you have all these parents refusing the tests. And so I actually wrote the epilogue of my book to try to say, listen, this is one of the best aspects of American participatory democracy. This is like the Boston Tea Party, the Civil Rights Movement, other causes where just large groups of people are coming together and saying, listen,
No.
we're no, exactly.
Now, do you have any take on the Trump administration's Department of Ed?
So I am friends with a bunch of homeschool parents in Michigan, and they said that Betsy DeVos refused to work with the anti-Common Core movement and supported a lot of candidates in Michigan and nationally who were pro-Common Core. So when she got nominated, all of a sudden there was on her webpage something that said along the lines of, I have never supported Common Core. And it was a little bit legalese, that you could kind of maybe say that, so she's covering her.
And Trump, on a few occasions,
He
was
tweet.
well, he criticized Common Core as another top-down program of the experts in DC.
Yes,
But he didn't really go into education policy, isn't his thing.
it's not his thing, but my interpretation of the current political scene is that Congress holds a lot of cards, that the Every Student Succeeds Act specifies what states have to do to get federal financial funding. And when it passed, Senator Lamar Alexander of Tennessee said, this is the greatest return to local control in 25 years. But as I read the law, it actually has a lot of specific things about standards, about the requirements of states, what kind of standards they have to adopt if they want fi federal financial funding. So my interpretation is that as long as the Every Student Succeeds Act stays the same, it's going to be very hard for states to escape the Common Core or something very similar.
They need the funding.
Well, it's
Or
not,
they think they need
they
the
think they
funding.
need they think they need the funding. I mean, I think something like New York gets $1.6 billion a year, and I think New York spends over $40 billion a year on education. So percentage-wise, it's small. But and yet I think a lot of the same way that you can use a tiny little rope to steer an elephant, I think it's a similar type thing that states think they have to comply with the federal mandates. And technically that's not the case. So I mean what the exit policy as I see, or exit plan as I see, is that we have to keep generating enough support to change the system and give states and localities a certain amount of freedom.
Professor Tampio, thank you for coming.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.